From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. Evan Dawson is somewhere in the Finger Lakes this week with a good bottle of wine, or knowing him, probably several good bottles of wine, and his own summer reading. I'm Scott Feibusch, and while Evan is away, we are spending the week thinking about the same question he's been asking himself. What's good to read this summer? It is our second annual Summer Book Week, and we have a great lineup of authors, writers, publishers, and readers joining us all week long. You can see the whole list at our website, wxxinews.org. This hour, we kick off with what seems to have become a prerequisite for many writers who want to be taken seriously in the academic world, the Master's of Fine Arts degree. In the last two decades, the number of MFA programs in creative writing has almost quadrupled. From Iowa City to Syracuse to pretty much anywhere in the country, this time of year now finds more than 3,000 graduate students emerging with newly minted MFAs. But there is a pushback, too, as even some prominent holders of MFA degrees are saying that the programs shouldn't become an automatic step on the way to building a writer's life. Here to engage in that debate with us today are writers and teachers from all corners. Len Massinio has an MFA and teaches at Writers and Books, among other places. He's with us. We'll be hearing more about him. On the phone with us from Geneva is Melanie Conroy Goldman, who is a professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. She has an MFA and publishes as Melanie Minnie Lena Conroy Goldman, most recently in McSweeney's, and she's working on a new novel, The Likely World. And repeating her role for a second year as our first hour Summer Book Week guest, Rochester-based author Louise Wareham Leonard is the author of three books, including 52 Men, which we featured on last year's Book Week. Welcome, Louise.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start with you because you're sort of representing the counter opinion here, as not an MFA person, as somebody who has, I guess you'd say, sort of a doctorate in life experience.
I have a doctorate
at this point. So I'm going to let you kind of set this up first from your side of the argument, and then we'll launch into it with Len and with Melanie.
Okay. Well, my side of the argument is that full disclosure, I have one semester of an MFA that I did about 2 years ago. So I do know what the MFA is about because I did a semester and then I dropped out. But I just want to say first that I am 100% and more pro-education. I mean, just education, and more importantly, if you want to be a writer, exposure to books of all kinds. For me, education is about exposure. Like when I went to Columbia College, 17, 18 years old, world literature, international, I did comparative literature, French, you know, Russian, German, I mean, in translation, but I read and the humanities were and the core curriculum that Columbia still has. And I was very lucky because I wasn't a great student in high school, but when I went to college, I was just ready to work, and it was the best thing I've ever done. There was that, and I went through in 3 years, and I just worked from 5 to 11 or every night. I was at the library reading, and it really changed my life and it changed who I am. And I'm thoroughly in favor of any education that you can get to expand yourself. However, the MFA, so part of the MFA is about providing you with reading lists and is about reading. So wonderful, fantastic, right? That's great. That's what you go for. Although you can get all of those reading lists quite easily online. You can get all of that information without paying $10,000 per semester, which if I had continued on, I already owe $15,000 from one semester. So I'm going to be paying that off. So I was like looking at it and I was like, wait a minute, if I finish this, I'm going to be $100,000 in debt. I've already published two books. Actually, I was working on my third, which has now been published. And the only reason to really get an MFA really is if you want to teach in universities, in which case you must get an MFA. If you don't have an MFA, it's very difficult to get a teaching job. Okay, so those are but the problem with the MFA as writers see it, the one is that you're working with a group of people who may or may not have your aesthetic. Everybody's got a different aesthetic at this point. People are trying to write genre fiction these days, or historical novels, or literary fiction. And just because these people are there, they can be very, very damaging because they can really give you bad advice. And I've had that happen. And when I was there, Should I continue? Or
please, yeah.
Okay. So when I was there, this is my one. MFA programs are being accused. The accusation is that they make everybody sound the same. And there is a sameness to an MFA writer. And if I pick up a book, I can sometimes tell. If I pick up a book at the library, Rochester, I can say, oh, this is an MFA career writer. I can just tell. And there I go to the acknowledgments pages, and sure enough, there's the list of all the NYU professors or the Columbia professors. Or they're career writers. And, you know, writing... So there's a tendency when you get a group to make people conform, okay? And what the most important thing about writing is that it has to be original. So you've got two things working against each other. Writing is about risks and challenging yourself and being daring. And MFA programs are about fitting into a structure. And the best writers can survive it, but some people I don't think will survive it. So my one personal story is I went there with the manuscript of 52 Men already, and I don't think I'd finished it, but I presented some of this book.
Which, well, we say there, which program were you at?
Well, I don't want to say then, because that would be okay. That would be outing that program,
okay,
and making
fair
them.
Enough.
But I went there, and I went there partly because I thought, oh, I can present my work. Great. So first of all, the professor's like, well, you can't present that work because you've already been working on it. And I said, okay, fine. But you know, I sneaked in a little bit there, and the group told me, to cut a long story short, the group, the 12 people who looked at my work, said. They told me that it's 52 men, so there are 52 stories with a hidden story at the end. So these 52 are not in order per se, right? So the consensus of the opinion was you need to put this in order to make it more understandable. And the whole point of the book was that it wasn't in order. That was the point. That's what makes it original. That's why some people hate the book, and that's why some people love the book. It's not a research paper, okay? You can teach people to write a research paper. You cannot teach people how to be creative and how to experiment and be brave. And it can be very damaging to have people come along and they don't know understand what you're doing. So they try to bring it to something they can understand. So if I had followed their advice, I would have written a very ordinary commercial book that would now be out there. And I didn't want to write a commercial, ordinary book. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being commercial, but that wasn't the book for that. So that was a problem for me. Okay.
Okay. I want to go now to Melanie. Are you with us from Geneva, Melanie?
We got you. I am.
Here. You are. Welcome. I want to go to you and set us up a little bit with your academic background. And then if you want to launch into an explanation of why, in your context, an MFA does matter.
Sure, I'd be delighted. Thank you so much for having me on the program. So by coincidence, I'm also a Columbia undergrad. So I went through that same Great Books curriculum and believe strongly in reading. And I ended up at an MFA program at the University of Oregon. And I think that there are, first of all, I don't think that an MFA is a requirement for being a writer. Far from it. Many writers are fostered in the school of life or are autodidacts in some way or other. But the MFA offers some things that I think can be valuable to many, many people who see a future for themselves in writing. And I think the first thing is a cohort. And I guess that's the flip side of the 12 people who make you conform. In a good workshop, you have 12 voices who care about your work, invest in it deeply, read it carefully, and provide you with a way of reflecting on your own work. And writers work in a solitary way, and yet we produce our work for an audience. And in some way, we need to learn over a lifetime how to internalize an audience, how to know how someone will respond to a joke or to a character trait or to a scene or to an illustration of suspense. And having readers that you learn to trust, and the workshop can provide that, is a way of learning to internalize that audience so that you can both be your own reader and be a writer who's working in solitude. The second thing I think the MFA can give you is mentorship. because writing is a long trail. Even successful, accomplished writers with many books behind them have moments of doubt, have moments in every single book, in every single short story, in every single project, where they fear they can't complete it. And mentorship is something that helps you figure out a way to get through those moments of block or self-doubt, and can provide you with guidance. And the last thing an MFA can do is, and there is probably too much emphasis on this in the MFA world now, but it can provide you with connections that move you forward, both in the academic world and in terms of publishing. So I left my MFA program, and one of my mentors, Peter Ho Davis, who's bringing out a wonderful book called The Fortunes this summer, helped me get my first job. And my mentors along the way introduced me to people who could help me expand my career. It's a really competitive world out there, and those people matter to me. And this summer when I got my agent, or last winter when I got my agent, it was my mentor, the same mentor, Peter Ho Davis, who suggested that I approach Bill Clegg, who became my agent. And I graduated in 1997. So he's someone who's been with me for my entire career. So those are three things that I think an MFA can provide. And I think sometimes people's frustration with them stems from their feeling, their expectation that an MFA will provide other things, make writing easier, which it never is, or guarantee publication, which it cannot do, or guarantee an academic job, which it also does not do.
We are talking about the MFA, the Masters of Fine Arts degree, in this case in creative writing. I'm Scott Feibusch. This is Connections from WXXI. It is our summer book week. And Melanie, you had mentioned audience. We want to bring our audience in on this as well. You can call into the discussion at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-TALK. On Twitter, at Scott Feibusch, S-C-O-T-T-F-Y-B. USH, and let's get our third voice in the studio in with us as well. Len Massinio, you are a published author in a whole bunch of venues. You are a teacher in a whole bunch of venues. And I want to bring in also kind of in this question of audience, you're also a musician. And let me ask you first off, given what Melanie was saying about the need to have an audience as a writer, kind of put that in the context also with music.
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things that I think musicians are well served by is when we trot out a new song, you can almost tell instantly whether the audience is receptive to it or not. I think one of the most difficult aspects of writing is we have an invisible audience, and we learn over a period of years, many years, as to who our ideal audience is and to what the nature of that audience is, what they're receptive to. One of the areas that I was in before I went into the MFA program, I studied under Walter J. Ong, who worked a great deal with Marshall McLuhan. And Walter J. Ong used to always say, you're writing to someone. It's a matter of determining who that person you're writing to is. Now, there's other ways to come at that. For instance, the reason, and both Melanie and Louise mentioned this, the reason that reading is so important is that encrypted in every book you read is an imagined audience, and we pick up almost, as it were, intuitively who that audience is. I certainly agree that anyone could master the art if they read sufficiently. It's by now an old chestnut, but Samuel Johnson used to say, you have to go through a library of books before you're able to write one book. I do agree with Melanie that the opportunities, if you're in a good MFA program, are inestimable. It really does favor people who have not as yet brought their writing to an attentive audience, one of the aspects that I mention in my classes at Writers and Books is that all sophisticated readers are good critics of everything but their own work. And that's a problem that we all face as writers. It, I think, falls upon the writer to learn to critique his own work as he would critique someone else's, to develop that objectivity. That objectivity is hard to come by. One of the exercises I use with my students, and it's very productive. All right, we've looked at your story. It's been critiqued. We've decided that your audience here, your critique group, like this aspect and they like this aspect. They've gone through the effort of not only saying what they like, but they've determined what the reason is why it works or it doesn't work. Now you name five things that are wrong with this manuscript. It's by way of shifting the emphasis from the right brain, which I think is one of the origins of our creativity, to the left brain, to the critical aspect. And again, criticism is the hardest thing to assert on our writing.
Let me ask you, and this kind of comes back to the point that Louise made before about homogenization. Is there a danger, and Melanie, if you want to chime in on this too, is there a danger in that reading process of taking away enough of an individual voice? And especially I'm thinking, Louise, of the very strong voice that you have in your writing. I mean, your writing is intensely personal. 52 Men is not a book that anybody else but you could have written.
Thank you.
Is there a danger there in taking some of those sharper, stronger, more confident voices and making them sound like everything else that's out there?
Well, I don't think so, but I would defer to people who are more familiar with the wide-ranging genre that exists now, the hybridization that's going on over and over again. I do agree with your point, Louise, that there is a danger you could be forced into a mold. My perspective, and before I got into creative writing, I was into theory and criticism of the novel. I was into rhetorical studies. And by nature, I'm an Aristotelian. And it's intriguing to me that all the principles, all the aspects that regulate writing ultimately come from Aristotle. Even if you're talking about fan fiction, or if you're talking about steampunk, or if you're talking about romance novels, ultimately all writing has a point. It also has arguments. The arguments in creative writing aren't logical. They're not by reason of the ethos of the speaker. They're actions, what Aristotle calls imitations of actions. Writing is cathartic. It's cathartic for the same reason in Aristotle's time, who used Aristophanes and Sophocles and Euripides as his model for writing. They're cathartic in the same way. In other words, the tropes of writing are the same everywhere. Now, again, there are bad programs out there, and there are teachers who ought not to be into teaching writing workshops. Now, my perspective is a little bit different. I went into a writing program when I was in my 40s, Wichita State University, and I just happened to have, and Melanie mentioned this, I had a very good mentor, James Lee Burke, who's written about 27 books. And I found him, even though his writing is very different from mine, to be generous in his criticism. And in fact, the program I was in, they were very supportive of writers. And I think they were differential to the fact, again, I think Louise's experience in her program wasn't as positive. They were very differential to different perspectives, different styles of writing. So, you know, again, and I'm asked this by my students a lot of times, if you're going to pick a program, what you want to do, you want to know the writers who are teaching in that program. You want to do your background work. You want to find out as much information before you go in.
And you're making, as Louise pointed out, you're making an investment here that absolutely is a very sizable amount of money.
Can I just say, I mean, for those who don't want to spend, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 and who are not planning, I mean, I have two major points. One is that I'm not against the MFA. I think a strong writer will make it through the MFA, and a strong writer cannot be stopped. You know, there's no amount of criticism or put downs. You know, you have to be real writers can take it all, bring it on, the criticism. You know, you got to be that way, or you're not going to survive, in my experience. And I have taken a lot of workshops. When I left college, I used to go to the Poetry Society of America. I went to workshops at the Writer's Voice. I went to the other. I'm just saying, you don't have to do an MFA. Right? There are a lot of things you can do. You can go. I went to the Vermont Studio Center. I spent a month there, and then I went on staff there.
Yeah.
And I was on staff for a year. In that year, I met Charlie Baxter, Jonathan Franzen, Amy Hempel, Donald Revelle. Like, I met 14 wonderful writers, several of whom blurbed my first book. So, you know, I didn't have to spend all that money. I'm just saying, you don't. There are other ways to do it. You can get a mentor. I'm a mentor. I edit. I help people. I did a program through in Humber College in Toronto. It was online. I worked with a short story writer, and she helped me a lot with my first book. Yeah. But it was $700, and she helped me immensely. But there are other ways to get that education. Go
these alternatives are something I want to get into. We have to take a quick break. We've got Bob still on the phone here. We're going to get to you, Bob, right after the break, when we continue as we talk about the MFA in creative writing here on Connections from WXXI. And in our next hour, stay tuned, because we are going to turn our attention to music writing. The Jazz Festival, of course, is right around the corner here in Greater Rochester. We will have Andy Babukin with us. He has intensely studied the Beatles and the instruments they used. He's got a brand new edition of his book, Beatles Gear, coming out, and he will be with us in our next hour. So stay with us here on Connections from WXXI. We'll be right back. And we are still in the midst of conversation here on Connections. This is good. It's one of those conversations that keeps going right through the break, which means it's a good one. I'm Scott Feivosh, in for Evan Dawson. It is Summer Book Week, our second annual Summer Book Week. And now that we've done two of them, we can actually say annual and be grammatically correct about that. Remember, there is complete information at our website, WXXINews.org, about the entire week's lineup here on Connections. We'll be hearing from Sonia Livingston tomorrow. We will have a discussion with local booksellers and librarians as well. Richard Russo coming up later in the week as well. Lots of good stuff ahead for you on Connections. But right now we are talking about the Masters of Fine Art in Creative Writing. Bob has been on the phone with us at 844-295-TALK. And Bob, I want to bring you on. Your experience having gotten an MFA later in your life.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks to the panelists. Just a quick bit of background. I have an MFA from Bennington College through their low residency program, which is a form of MFA that enables people, regardless of their age or where they are in life, to work, which I did full-time for a major corporation, and at the same time begin the discipline of writing. Because after all, an MFA, regardless of the subject, if you will, is about creating the work, as your panel has pointed out. So I was fortunate in having that opportunity. I was also fortunate to work, as Bennington has a tradition of practitioners being teachers as opposed to simply academics. And so I studied with Bob Shacochis, George Packer, Susan Cheever, and the late Lucy Greeley. the cohort that someone brought up still resonates with me today. I have friends. I was published before I went into the MFA program as a freelance writer. But the nonfiction focus that I had and have, it's a craft. I would no more think about becoming a craftsman in anything, whether it's woodworking or painting, without coaching, without being a part of a group that would have let me get the feedback that I think everyone's talked about. As to having a voice, I think part of the process is discovering your voice. If you come in with one already, why are you in the program, as I think Louise pointed out? But if you're discovering that voice and working with it, having the coaching there has been tremendous. It was a significant experience in my life, continues to influence me. But as I think Len pointed out, you have to do the homework on the program. Now, I'd like to end, thank you for listening, I'd like to end with a question. Why do you think there's such an explosion of MFA writing programs that's gone on? Bennington was one of the early ones. Why is that happening? And where are all these great teachers coming from? And why isn't there an explosion in MFA, say, for painting? So I'll take myself offline.
All right. Thanks for the comments, Bob. I want to get you into that, Melanie, please. Yes.
And it sounds a little cynical, but I think it does point out a distinction that has come up a number of times in our conversation. So there are some universities and colleges that use an MFA as a money-making arm. Mm-hmm. So they charge full price for their students to come, and that tuition money feeds other aspects of the university. And it's not necessarily for-profit schools or schools that you would suspect it of. Columbia University, where I went to undergraduate, made money off its arts division. So one thing that that prospective writers who are interested in an MFA can do is to look for schools that provide a lot of funding. So that way, you don't leave the program in enormous debt. In fact, you can leave the program. I left my program at the University of Oregon, which provides full funding to all of its students, and I left the program with $2,000 in debt, and that was it after 2 years. And I had some teaching experience, and that kind of program is one where you're less likely to leave feeling like maybe it wasn't worth it.
But can I just say Melanie must be a very, very, very gifted writer, because, you know, they're getting into those programs, if you look at the statistics, are pretty high. It's very difficult to get into those programs. So kudos to you. She must be the real thing, because I'm just saying it's not easy to get in. And I looked in Syracuse. Is supposed to be fantastic.
Yeah, and those statistics are jarring. You've got of the 3,000 people who graduate from a program from these programs in any given year, the numbers, it's something like 20,000 people who apply. And I guess it raises the question too. It's something that you wonder about in a lot of professions now, including in the broadcast journalism world, where there is, by the way, a very similar discussion about, do you need to go for a graduate journalism degree, or are you better off learning the craft in the field? And in my career, I took the latter approach, and I have not had cause to regret it, but neither have I gone on to teach it academically. But there is that question of, okay, you go out and you spend all this money on a degree, and if you're writing for small journals, if you're writing for a lot of the places where these MFA grads get published, you're lucky in a lot of cases to get paid, period, much less enough to pay this back. Melanie, do you want to speak at all to the economics of this for somebody especially who's younger in life considering this path?
Yeah, I mean, I teach a lot of students who are really interested in going into MFAs and being writers, and I've seen some really talented writers not get into programs because Louise is correct. It is painfully competitive, and I appreciate your compliment, Louise, but it was a lot less competitive when I was getting in. So I acknowledge that it's certainly competitive to get those spots. But that doesn't mean there, you know, just as an undergraduate compares cost when thinking about, oh, should I go to community college? Should I go to a four-year college? Should I go to private or state? There are variations in cost, variations in funding. There's outside funding. So, it isn't necessary to leave a school $100,000 in debt. If you are going into $100,000 worth of debt, though, you should be able to afford it, because it is absolutely true that an MFA is not like a law degree, and a law degree isn't even like a law degree anymore, but it's not like an MD where you have a guaranteed mode of income when you leave.
Well, yeah, and on the flip side, I mean, you wouldn't go to a lawyer who didn't have a degree hanging on the wall. You wouldn't go to a doctor who hadn't been through umpteen years of medical school. And yet there are plenty of writers that I'd be delighted to read who may have never really set foot in a formal writing classroom. Is that?
But of course, the MFA is only a recent look at. I was looking at the Goodreads top 100 novels. You know, Salinger, Fitzgerald, Hemingway. You know, everybody. None of these people had MFAs. We just have to remember that. Let's bring that back to just the point that nobody had an MFA. When I was coming up, the MFA was kind of this vague thing. It wasn't. And I was at the time writing professionally. I kind of wish I'd done it earlier because of the teaching credential. And you know what? The thing is, writers want to write. They want to be around writing. They want to, I would still, if somebody offered me full funding right now, I'd probably go do the MFA because I love to read. I love to write. Why wouldn't I? You know, so that's how writers are. They're like, they don't care how much money it costs. You know what I mean? So I'm just saying it's a complicated thing. And I understand why there's a proliferation because they did well and because writers are very serious about it. And I made huge sacrifices to be a writer. I mean, I really did. But I knew that when I quit my full-time job as a travel writer flying around the world at age 28, God wish I had that job now. I was prepared to have a drop in salary and to be making $18,000 a year living in Manhattan. I mean, I did that for years, years and years and years.
Like a lot of travel writers wish those jobs were still
around. Oh, it was. I had a very good, yes.
I do want to mention one thing that I don't think it might not have been given justice. I think Melanie picked up on it a little bit. Louise's notion that we are working in a community where a community of writers. Writing has been called a sullen art for good reason. Everybody remembers the movie The Shining with Jack Nicholson. It's
all work and no play.
Yeah, really. And one of the advantages of being in a community and being in a community for a year, as a matter of fact, I know there's a great distant learning programs. Bob mentioned one, Bennington, but I really enjoyed most, in spite of the fact I was in the workplace at the time, I enjoyed most being at Wichita State University simply because of the collegiality of it. And it was not only between students, it was between students and teachers. And it went way beyond our writing commitment. They became lifelong relationships. And again, I think writers, I think Margaret Atwood says, you're a writer because you can't not write. I think writers long for the kind of support. Again, it's something we afford them. I'm sure it's been Louise's experience at Writers in Books. We create, as it were, aggregates of people who are interested in writing. They in turn form their own writing groups. They support each other generously, hopefully by being while being critical of each other's writing. And we, in a sense, do what all internships, it doesn't matter whether you're a doctor or a surgeon or you're a lawyer, you have to go through that very painful process when you try to launch a career of getting submissions out there, getting rejected. You need to have some reinforcements. And I do think that writing programs provide that.
You don't need to if you're strong, you know, if you're tough enough. But can I just say...
I just want to remind everybody we're listening to Connections on WXXI. If you have, if you've joined us in the last few minutes, Len Massinio is an instructor at Writers and Books. And I want to get the plug in here that on Thursday in our noon hour, as part of Summer Book Week, we are going to be hearing from both the outgoing and incoming leaders of Writers and Books as we make this big historic handoff from Joe Flaherty, who founded the organization. So they will be with us on Thursday at 1. That's part of our summer book lineup. On the phone with us from Geneva is Melanie Conroy Goldman, who's a professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and Louise Wareham Leonard, author of 52 Men, is in the studio. And there's still a chance for you to get in with us in our last 15 minutes or so here, 844-295-TALK on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. And having said that, Louise.
No, it was just one thing I wanted to say was that ultimately, if you can take it, there's never anything wrong with studying. But what really concerns me a little bit more is in my career, is that, like I was just saying, the MFA didn't really exist. And now what worries me is when I pick up literary journals, I read poetry for Tin House, as in I help to decide, you know, vote on whether it's, you know, up, yes or no. And what I see a lot now is that people are going from BAs to MFAs to assistant professor to associate professor, and their entire lives are spent in academia. And it is a real problem, because I counted, like, I had a list the other day in Poets and Writers. They had all of these contemporary writers. I'd say 80 to 90% of them were working within the system. So that means that really worried me, because it means what I see from student writing is people who all having the same experiences in life. And really, I say that quite sincerely. It's a real problem. Like, you don't, you know, like, I mean, I've had so many different jobs. I've worked in a seminary. I've worked in an investment bank. I've worked in the outback of Australia. I mean, I've really struggled to make money, you know, struggled and continue to work all these different jobs. But I'm only just starting to get to my material. You know.
Well, I do want to address that, though, because, you know, again, I think there's a mistaken notion that we're being forced into some mold, and that we have to thereafter, or that we've been trained, as it were, overtrained, so we have to stay within that literary school idiom. I don't think so.
It's dangerous. It's competitive.
It is.
It's safe because it's a safe salary and it's a conventional job.
Okay. Yeah. But few people actually who get MFAs get instructorships.
I'm talking about the successful writers in this country. 90% of them being professors. I'm sorry, but that's just not, that's scary to me. Where are the writers who are doing other things in life?
One of the things that people don't appreciate enough is you have to learn what the rules are before you could break the rules. And, you know, like, again, I don't think...
We can't wake up at 50 or 60 and decide to become an interesting person and do interesting things when you've spent, you know, 30 years in the ivory tower. You just can't... remake yourself at 60. People try to do that a lot. They come in at 60 and say, I'm going to write this. Some of them can write at 60.
It's too late, and
we've got a gazillion of those books out there, and that's what's boring.
I would be the first person to admit that a lot of people who write academically are... writing tenure papers, they're hacks.
Not hacks, but it's just there's no diversity of experience.
But you're talking about academic
writing.
I bet Melanie would like to weigh in, which I understand. No insult to you, but you know it's.
Oh no, no, not at all. You know, sure. But I think that the relationship between academia and writing is much more permeable than the way that you're illustrating it. For example, at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, we run a year-long residency for nationally known writers. And we're bringing in Jeff Vandermeer next year. We had Mary Gateskill, Mary Ruffel, some wonderful writers. We support them in academia for a year. They have a very low teaching load, and we hope that
great.
We
you can invite me next. I'm ready. I'm coming. I'm coming. Here I come.
They don't call the show Connections
on the
for
list.
Nothing.
So no, we do have a lot of writers who visit academia in some sense or other as a way of providing a more stable income. And I think
that's
that academia facilitates a life for many writers who are writing
the same life
inside and outside of academia.
The same life. And that's, you know, the same life. You know, that's my only concern. Is this the same life? It's like, well, do it for 10, 20 years. Go out and do something as well.
Well, I think a little bit about, I think, for example, of Tom Piazza, who was our first Trias writer in residence. And he lives in New Orleans. And he wrote a wonderful book called Why New Orleans Matters. And he wrote for the television show Tremé, and
that's my point, though. Exactly. He's outside. He's not a full-time professor. He hasn't done that for 30 years. He's been out there doing other things. And it's wonderful that you can be a visiting writer. That's great support for people who maybe have missed out. I mean, I'm not saying it's been easy to be outside of that. I envy in some ways that life that I did not choose. And I'm not saying it's a bad. I envy it in some ways, but
he's right near the end of the hour here, and I want to jump in with a couple of more questions, particularly for you, Melanie, since you're working with, I'm assuming, primarily a somewhat younger group of students.
Yes, that's the case, although I recently completed a semester of volunteer work with incarcerated people. Mm-hmm. So I've worked with a pretty big variety of students.
Speaking of having life experience.
I've been into the prisons, but not as a teacher, let me just say that, okay? I've been in the prisons, not as a teacher.
I want to ask Melanie here, what's your assessment? You know, we have this generation, and you know, some of this was satirized a couple of years ago, on the HBO show Girls, where you had one of the characters going off to Iowa and participating in the Iowa Writers Workshop, and that's sort of the original program and sort of the stereotype of it. Is there reason to be confident, or at least hopeful, that the current generation of students are getting the kind of life experiences that Louise is talking about? Or is there this sense now that there's sort of this regimented program that maybe didn't exist a generation or two ago for them to aspire to?
I have heard of the stereotype of the MFA story or the workshop story, but that's not the kind of teaching that I've seen in practice. I'm not saying it's not out there. I'm sure it is. The stereotype must exist for a reason. But what I see are teachers who think of themselves as, well, the word the caller used was a coach, right? And, some writers are tough, like Louise said, and some writers have been told their whole lives that writing isn't worth doing, that they can't be writers if they're not good spellers, or, you know, other things that families or schools that don't know how to foster creativity don't teach. And an ideal writing teacher, and I think a lot of great teachers exist, fosters the creative voice, helps a student learn how to withstand the criticism and also the rejection that Lem was talking about that just goes with the territory, and to be faithful to their voice, right? I mean, a great program, a great MFA program, is as much about finding and protecting and honing your originality as it is about learning anything technical. And so I think that students who learn writing in an academic context with these teachers that I know and have encountered are going to produce some amazing writing, and they're going to be some of the wonderful writers that we're reading 10 years from now. And some of those writers are going to come from somewhere totally other than academia. But I don't think that academia is ruining writing.
Are there situations, and I'll ask both Melanie and Len, Are there situations where you see, you know, either a budding writer or maybe somebody with a little more experience coming to you where you would say, you know what, no, the MFA program is absolutely not the right thing for the direction that you're going in or for your particular personality, and maybe you should consider doing something different? Would you advise somebody against it under certain circumstances?
Well, yeah, I would. I do. And I would say in particular for genre writers, there are some great genre programs, and there are more than there used to be. But for students who are enthusiastic about writing sci-fi and fantasy, which is, you know, a lot of young people are, there are very few programs that are friendly to them. And there are a lot of great alternatives, like the Clarion Writers Workshop, which isn't an MFA program, but is taught by fantastic people and turns out great writers. So that's one example.
Len, you want to weigh in on this?
I really think that it depends a great deal on the temperament of the person who wants to go into an MFA program. I think MFA programs are an accelerative form of learning, and it is contingent. I want to dignify your point, Louise. There are a lot of people who go into the program who do not have many life experiences. I'm sure Melanie would confirm this. There's a lot of people who show up at the doors of academe and they've read Hemingway and they write stories about ambulance drivers who are working on a war front
and in Spain.
You know, like they've read some Hemingway and they've said to themselves, I could do that, or they've read Elmer Leonard and they say, oh, I could do that, not realizing that Hemingway worked at great length to make his manuscripts as terse and strong as they were, or that Elmer Leonard served an apprenticeship of 20 years. I do think that rule that says to achieve expertise in anything, you have to put in your 10,000 hours. And I figured that out one time for one of my students. That constitutes about 4 hours a day if you're a serious writer for 7 years without exception. Again, I think of the MFA as something that depends on the disposition of the writer. I think it's for some people very, very good because it's the fast grow of writing. But I also believe, I remember in The World According to Garp, John Irving's book, that Garp's mother learns how to write a book simply by reading a book, one book. She, in effect, tears that one book apart and masters all the techniques in that one book. And again, she went up the steep side of the mountain. She did it very successfully. You know, again, academe isn't for everyone, and I quite agree that if you're going to invest that much money, you need to recognize that MFAs are not subject to headhunting. There's nobody out there who's rushing to the campuses and trying to promote us to write our novel. Again, I think it's...
There are no IPOs in publishing.
There's, yeah, well put. So, you know, like, again, I gained immeasurably from it. You know, it was a great experience for me. As I said, my mentor was James Lee Burke. He worked in the oil derrick south of the border. He was an alcoholic that ran in every alien, peed in every garbage can for 10 and 15 years. So by the time he got into writing and became successful, he had a lifetime of experiences to write about. And, you know, again, I think, you know, the richness of your writing always depends on the richness of your experience.
It sounds like there is some degree of consensus. We're down to our last couple of minutes here, at least consensus on that point. Melanie, if you've got a couple of last words, a couple of last thoughts from your perch there in Geneva.
Well, I think the thing that occurs to me listening to Lynn is that we need to learn to think of ourselves as writers. People who want to be writers have a hard time accepting that mantle, maybe thinking of it as legitimate. And an MFA is a place where you can be treated like a writer, where you can make time to be a writer.
Okay. Got about 20 or 30 seconds left, Louise. I'm thinking you never had a lot of lack of confidence about being a writer.
Oh, gosh, I was pushed into it violently from the age of, the minute I arrived in this country, I was 12, I swear, every single teacher, that's what you do. I was pushed and forced. And
there's a whole discussion to
It's a whole nother discussion.
When we have you back for year three of Book Week next year.
Thank you. That would be great. But first I'm going to be visiting with Melanie.
There we go. Len Massinio, Writers and Books, Melanie Conroy-Goldman from Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and Louise Wareham-Leonard, the author of 52 Men. Thank you so much for being with us here on Book Week. We are back in just a little bit with Andy Babuke talking about Beatles gear. Stay with us.